And all the previous cases that I've been involved with, where the situation is like this here, it's always been a recovery. It's never been a...
Please, God. Please,
a happy ending.
Bring her home.
You will start to question whether a memory is real or false only when that element of memory or that...
Why did his father leave him in a ditch in the middle of nowhere, then lie about it and disappear?
From eye scrapings and evasive nose probings to incisions in the skin, John of God has performed countless unlicensed surgical procedures, seemingly with no anesthesia.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. This is part four, the final episode on Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell, but it's more importantly about the beautiful people they left behind. Before we talk about what happened to these two precious babies, I want to honor them for who they were. They were two siblings that truly loved each other. Tylee's best friend said in a CBS article and documentary, quote, "When I think of Tylee and JJ, I just think of fun and love. They both had unconditional love for each other. I'll always remember them like that," said Vicia, Tylee's best friend. These poor babies had their whole lives ahead of them. JJ was described as a firecracker, but just the sweetest and coolest one. And he was creative, and he just really seemed like a doll of a kid. He loved to dance, and he loved his scooter. And perhaps my favorite, well, and most heartbreaking moment in the ID documentary, Doomsday, The Missing Children, is the way his grandpa Larry reacts to speaking to a neighbor about JJ's last days. Here's a clip from that.
Knocked on the door of the neighbor next door, and her kids, their kids, were JJ's playmates, and they played with him often.
Hi.
Hi.
Look, I know you don't know us.
No, you're JJ's grandparent.
I am JJ's grandfather and just JJ's grandmother. I understand that you allowed your children to play with him. And I want you to understand, he is my heart. JJ is my heart. And before Lori left, how was JJ? I just want to know.
Did he seem angry?
Angry or out of control?
No, JJ seemed really happy.
This is where he rode his scooter at, because he loves to ride a scooter. Did he have a scooter here?
Yeah, all sorts of rolly toys, and he would set up jumps and go off it.
That's my boy.
And Tylee, she seemed like a beautiful, freckled-faced teen on the verge of a wonderful life. Her friends loved her. She was very intelligent, and she was also very loving. And she would have gone on to do amazing things with her life. I truly believe that. I'm just so sorry for both Tylee and JJ that their potential was ruined by people who selfishly took them from this earth. I have two interviews for this final episode that will help shine a light on the most up-to-date coverage on this case. Here's John Glatt, New York Times best-selling true crime author and investigative journalist, giving his insight on this case based on his research and the book he wrote called The Doomsday Mother.
Hello, yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, and it sounded great, so we're all good.
Excellent, yeah. Okay, fire away.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Pleasure.
I literally just freaked out a second ago when I was looking at what books you wrote. So you've written 25 books.
Actually, 25 true crime. I've also written another 5 books, kind of biographies and... kind of books on rock and roll when I first started.
Oh, cool. What are your rock and roll ones?
Well, I did a book. I've done 2 books on Bill Graham, you know, the San Francisco promoter from the 60s, 70s. And I wrote a book on the Chieftains. I wrote their authorized biography. And also I've written books on Monaco and River Phoenix.
Oh, wow. The River Phoenix cover that? Grew up in a cult?
Yes, exactly. Children of God. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm so impressed by your in-depth research on the Lori Vallow, Chad Daybell case. And so I was looking through your other books, and my next one on the list is the one about Ariel Castro and those beautiful girls that he, Michelle Knight, Amanda Berry, Gina De Jesus. Scares the shit out of me, but I'm looking forward to hearing your take on it.
Yeah, that was Cleveland. Yeah, I went down there. And And also, I wrote a book in about Chris Watts in, you know, in Colorado, where you're moving to. I was down there.
So you go. So you're, you know, a very, you know, well-renowned investigative journalist. So you go to the places often, and do you interview people in person when you write these?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the Doomsday Mother, to be honest, was because of COVID. You know, I didn't. I did everything by telephone. You know, interviews there. I didn't want to go. You know, travel last year. It was a little dangerous. Or in fact, it was 2 years ago. It would have been 2020. Yeah. So no, I didn't interview in person for that one. But every other book I've written, I have.
You have a book called Pariah of Sin, Clergy Who Kill.
Yeah, that was my first, I think, first true crime book.
Oh, really?
It's an anthology. I think it's 12 or 13 cases of priests that, you know, committed murder. I wrote it, I think, in 1997, 1998. So it was my very first true crime book, in fact.
Interesting. Let's get into this case now. So you've done a lot of brilliant work on absolutely horrible people. But did Chad and Lori Vallow kind of, or Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow rank, what do you think of them?
Well, I mean, I got quoted, I was interviewed on it, and I said, I think it's the most terrifying case I've ever done, ever covered. Because, I mean, you know, overtly, you know, they're very photogenic, at least Laurie is, you know. I don't know if you've seen, obviously you've seen pictures of her. She was even on Jeopardy many years ago. And she had a lot of and everything, but so much darkness with both of them. I mean, individually, I think if they'd never met, you know, I don't think any murders would have been committed or anything like that. But it was just this fatal kind of meeting. I think it's like Melanie Gibbs says, you know, it's like pouring a match on gasoline, and it literally exploded with all these deaths.
Yeah. Do you think that they are? So do you know the concept of like shared psychosis or whatever, or shared psychotic disorder? Do you think that one of them was crazy and then they, I don't know, made each other worse? Or,
well, I don't know. I mean, if you look at Laurie's history, she certainly came from a very, you know, a very unusual family. You know, she had a very strange upbringing. She's very, very disturbed. I don't know. Even before she met Chad, I mean, with what happened with Joe Ryan and stuff and her other husband, I mean, you know, it's kind of leading up to this, really. You know, she well could have been capable of murder. In fact, I think she rationalized it just before she met Chad. She gave some speech at Melanie Gibbs, kind of preparing a people. It was a little small party where she spoke about how she could have murdered Joe Ryan, you know, for what he'd done.
Do you believe what she's claiming Joe Ryan did to her children? Because normally I'd like to.
Absolutely not. I mean, I've got all the papers, all the reports from the police reports, and also the reports from the psychiatrist that interviewed, you know, Tylee and Colby and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that they was convinced that Laurie coached Tylee to say certain things, you know, that Joe Ryan had done. I don't think he did at all. I mean, although Colby to this day still insists that, you know, he was sexually molested by Joe Ryan, I really don't believe it. I think he was brainwashed by Lori too, you know, to some extent.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like his Dateline interview where he like it's a hard call because he like adamantly like claims it, but he does seem brainwashed when he's saying it. Even though he doesn't like his mom so much anymore, he still somehow believes this.
Yeah. I mean, in these reports, I think from this there was somebody, I think court-appointed person, you know, to that they were seeing at that point, And I mean, she was convinced. In fact, I think she caught Laurie out, you know, trying to coach Kylie. And Kylie would look at her all the time to make sure she said the right thing, basically, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't believe it.
Okay, mm-hmm. So now I want to go through a little bit of the timeline of, so I listened to your whole book minus maybe 30 minutes because I just ran out of time. Right. Some of the things that I had not known about were the owl necklace thing that Chad yeah. Daybelt was using and the portal in the closet. Can you yeah. explain some of that? And also early on in their relationship, how they already were having they already had burner phones to cover up their affair. Can you just kind of go through that sort of chapter? It's chapter 18.
Yeah, I mean, the owl necklace, this was explained to me by a guy called Eric Smith, who was Julie Rose. You know, I think they fell out recently, but at one point they were very close and they were all close. Mm-hmm. Chad and Eric would see him, and it became like a party trick, you know, where they would get certain people that believed in all this, you know, kind of apocalyptic stuff that Chad was preaching, and he had quite a following, especially among the ladies, I think, and he had this owl necklace, which I understand he found in a Mormon church, and kind of adapted it, and he had a special way of spinning it, you know, to answer certain questions. And it became like a party trick, really, Eric told me. And to impress people, he would actually go out and do research before these parties and come up with all these historical figures, find out a bit about them, and then tell somebody that his owl necklace revealed that they were so-and-so in a former existence, you know, or something. And he used it like a party trick, I think, you know. Yeah, I mean, his whole thing as an author, basically. I mean, I don't know if you've read any of his books. I mean, I actually, you know, for research, I got a couple and tried to read them, you know, one of the series. I mean, they're real dreck and they're really sort of so cliched and whatever. He's not a good writer. And but he had a certain position as an author in, you know, Mormon literature, which he really liked, you know, and he obviously had his own publishing company. He ran with Tammy. So that kind of made him important. You know, I think he had a thing where he really wanted to feel important all the time, you know, and have people look up to him.
Yeah. And I think you definitely have like read some of Rick Ross's stuff, and because you mentioned him in your book.
Well, I've interviewed Rick.
Oh,
sure. Yeah. I mean, I've interviewed Rick originally for the Cleveland abductions, Ariel Castro, I think it was that one. He was very, uh-huh. he was very helpful. You know, he's the acknowledged cult expert. So, you know, I called him up and he was very helpful, you know, and gave me, you know, told me what he felt about it, you know. And, you know, Chad was like a typical cult leader, you know, except he probably had a cult of one, you know, two, if you include Chad and Laurie, you know, although they were more mm-hmm. originally, you know, but. Yeah, that was very interesting, I thought.
So what did Rick Ross think of them? Because I think you said it was in your book, it was called personality-driven cult?
Yeah, well, I mean, he just thought he was, you know, Chad was just using a lot of these mind techniques that had been used for years by different cult leaders, you know, to control people. And he's kind of based in Mormon philosophy, which he's kind of taken to another level. It was kind of heretic, you know, Mormon philosophy. He, you know, it was kind of, he'd really twisted it, you know, to his own means.
So do you think, the thing that I've been grappling with is, do you think that either one of them are actually crazy, or do you think that they are narcissists or something?
Well, you can put it that simply. I mean, I don't know if they're crazy. To kill one's children like that is totally, I would think for anybody to do that is crazy, you know, whatever. But somehow they cloaked it in this kind of Chad's philosophy, you know, where his people had turned into zombies. And mm-hmm. in fact, they were doing them a favor to kill them because, you know, that was the only way these devils, these bad spirits were going to get out of the body. And they could reach a perfect place, which is kind of how it was explained, I think, to Alex, you know, who wasn't the most intelligent person on earth. And he literally believed it, you know, that, you know, Tylee and JJ had been possessed, you know, by zombies, and he was probably doing them a favor as his uncle.
But part of me also defaults to, like, was it just money motivated, too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think Chad was definitely motivated by money. I mean, look at the insurance policies. He cashed in Tammy's within, like, a week or something. And obviously with Charles Vallow, Laurie was horrified, you know, when she found that, you know, Kay Woodcock was now going to get it, you know, instead of her, which she was hoping for. So I think money was a motivation too, you know. But I mean, I think
when Laurie didn't get that million, it made me laugh. For what they did to those kids, I needed something to laugh about at their expense. I mean, that must have been a shocking discovery for her when she thought that her plan was all in place.
Yeah, I mean, I actually spoke to Kay and Larry Woodcock. I had a couple of conversations with them. Unfortunately, they didn't want to be quoted in the book because I believe they're doing their own. I don't know what's going on with that, but they were very, very helpful and pointed me in some good directions for interviews and stuff. And I mean, just from, you know, the hatred and the that came from Laurie to Kay when she realized that, in fact, you know, Charles's insurance policy had been changed and she wasn't getting any, you know. Well, you know, his wife's not getting anything, you know, to bring up JJ. She was absolutely furious. She showed her true colors there. Yeah.
Those grandparents break my heart. Have you watched that, ID Discovery documentary on them?
Oh, yeah, the three-part. I mean, they're amazing, and to me, they're the total heroes. And I think if it hadn't been for them kicking up a fuss because, you know, they couldn't get in touch with JJ and calling the police and everything, they could, you know, Laurie and Chad could well have got away with all of this, you know. It was Kay and Larry's, you know, heroic kind of pass they did to expose this evil, you know. That I mean, you know, I don't think it would have got exposed without them. I really don't.
Mm-hmm. And that email that Kay basically got into Charles's email by accident and saw the address of them.
That was amazing. I mean, I think they think it was something called from God. She couldn't sleep that night, as I understand. And she was going through his computer, and then she suddenly stumbled on all these emails and everything from Amazon, you know, and got the address, you know, in Rexburg, and that's when it all fell into place.
It's heartbreaking what those grandparents had to go through.
They totally loved JJ. I mean, I think they had to, you know, Larry had such a close relationship with him because, you know, JJ being an autistic and everything. And, you know, his birth parents couldn't look after him because, you know, they were compromised with drugs. And I think Larry fell in love with JJ and they broke their hearts, you know, with what happened. After the children disappeared, you know, after they were, you know, as we know now in hindsight, you know, they were murdered. I mean, Laurie took out a storage locker in Rexburg. And I guess they were preparing, you know, to move to Hawaii and whatever. And they were moving all this stuff. They moved all the children's clothes and possessions into this storage locker. And they moved, I mean, I think they had a quilt that Laurie had done with all their pictures. I mean, to all the, you know, everybody said she was a loving mother. And she seems to be, you know, on the outside. But they put all this stuff in the storage locker. And later, I think, with the video, they could see them coming in with stuff and bringing stuff in and taking stuff out and everything, you know. So that was quite key, I think, in the investigation when the police uncovered this storage locker. No, exactly. I mean, it was this very fuzzy video that they got from the cameras. And there was something that looked like it could have been an arm, but it wasn't, you know, it was something else. it was hard to tell exactly what they were bringing in and out, you know.
Now, the most shocking and it's extremely hard to listen to, because I listened to your book on Audible. I didn't read it.
I haven't listened to any of my audio books. So would you like the English, the guy that reads it?
Yes, he did a great job. He did a great job. No,
yeah.
I think it's good that, I mean, you're English too, yes?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Sometimes I can't tell if it's an Irish accent.
No, English.
Yeah, no, it was cool that I already knew you were English and his voice was English. That worked out very well.
Right.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. Good. The information was unbelievable. You have, I'm very type A and I research things like a psycho, and I learned about 90% more about this case from your book than I found anywhere else on the internet. Mm.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But so the chapter that was the most shocking and absolutely horrifying would be chapter 27, like how Alex killed those kids. And how do you know for sure that it was Alex?
Well, because the FBI have pointed his, they did his cell phone through the towers, and they did a tracking device. I think it's called CASE, the group that does it. And they could find out exactly where he was in real time, you know, during that period. And mm-hmm. that was in, you know, Chad Daybell's garden doing all this stuff, you know, or in Laurie Vallow's house. And they could pinpoint it. And that's where I put it all together. It was from the preliminary hearing, all the testimony, you know, from the FBI on that, and the investigator that did all that stuff. You could piece it all together, and then going backwards from how they discovered the bodies, you know, you could work it out.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, obviously, as I said in the book, only Alex will ever really know exactly what happened, you know. But I think, you know, we can, with quite precision, we can kind of work out what he did, you know.
Hello, Rachel.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Did you feel like your friend was capable of, I mean, that is horrible.
It's absolutely horrible. And I think I've made it really clear, like, Alex was my friend. I loved him. I'm so sorry that whatever happened in his brain, you know, made him do these unspeakable things. And so I'm not in any way trying to stand up for him. I'm really not. But at the same time, I'm not 100% sure that of the extent of his involvement. And what I mean by that is, like, when I think about the last night of JJ, David and Melanie both saw Alex carrying JJ in, right?
Uh-huh.
Into the house. He wasn't covered in duct tape and a garbage bag at that time. And
yeah.
Then the rest of what we know is when Lori said that he was downstairs climbing on kitchen cabinets, climbing on the refrigerator, acting like a zombie. That's the next thing we know. Well, David and Melanie, they're just in this little apartment. They never heard any of that. And so it mm-hmm. makes me think, me personally, I think Lori did that to that child. I think she taped him. She quieted him. She subdued him. And then she called Alex to come take him. It's what I think. And I could be wrong. I mean, I don't know that we'll ever know the complete, total truth. But, you know, she called Alex in the middle of the night, just like she called Alex in the middle of the night that Tylee was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did he help dispose of the bodies? Yeah, I'm pretty 100% sure of that. But did he
mm-hmm.
actually do the killing? That I'm really not sure of.
It's just so crazy to me. Like, I don't think I can chalk up Alex to just necessarily being dumb or something. Because especially, I mean, I interviewed my other friend Jill Kimmel for this as well, and
yeah.
who knew him. And both Mary and Jill thought he was a lovely person. Like, I don't really understand how you can go from being a lovely person to doing the most terrifying, horrible thing to a child.
But you even asked Mary. I mean, she knew him when he was, they're doing the comedy circuit. And he went to get Joe Ryan, you know, and he tried to kill him, I think, you know, basically. And it was for Laurie. She had a real hold over him, which nobody can really explain. You know, Mary said that they had a very strange relationship, you know, in Armageddon. And he had a task, they told Alex, he had a task to fill, you know, as part of this sacred mission. And part of it was to get rid of the zombies. And I think they kind of brainwashed him into thinking that, you know, Tylee, JJ and others had been taken over and possessed by evil spirits. And he felt he was, you know, doing his part of the mission to get rid of the bodies. I mean, so their souls could rise again. And I think Alex, you know, I'm not saying he's evil. I mean, I don't know how somebody could be that brainwashed to do something like that. And my personal feeling about it is that it got to him in the end, after killing JJ and then marrying Zulema. And I think his conscience caught up with him. And he went to Mexico. I think it was 2 or 3 days before he died, you know, suspicious circumstances. I mean, I know it was ruled, an accidental death, but I think he committed suicide, or he had like a, you know, he just, his heart gave out because he was feeling, you know, he was deeply regretful of what he'd done. That's just my personal, you know, take on it. I don't really know that for sure, but. Well, I mean, there was two, you know, there was JJ and Tylee, you know, originally. Tylee just kind of, they went to, I think, Yellowstone Park for that trip that day with Alex. They took photos, and Tylee was never seen again. You know, Laurie said, she's studying at BYU University, I think, Brigham Young University, told everyone that. Mm-hmm. But that same day, I think they had Alex, you know, that they had him in Laurie's place. In a house, I think they all lived in the same complex in Rexburg, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When they discovered the body, I mean, it had been burnt and mutilated, and it was, you know, it was in a terrible, terrible state. I mean, what he must have done to it is unthinkable, you know, because they could hardly recognize it as human remains, basically, you know. And it was only, I think, there was a mandible or part of a bone that they, through, I mean, dental records, which they kind of identified Tylee. But I mean, it was a horrible, horrible state.
And while investigators are finding the children like this, the most disturbing phone call I've ever heard in a long time of researching cases between Laurie and her equally dumbass new husband, Chad, occurs. And it's, again, baby talk, and it's in the most troubling and sad of circumstances possible. So Laurie had been arrested and put in jail for not producing the children, and Chad is still a free man, but not for long. He's sitting in his car and observing the investigators searching his backyard. And this is how they talk.
They call from and take their call.
Hi,
Dad.
Hello. Are you okay?
They're searching the property.
The house, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In the house. So, Mark means we'll be talking to you.
Okay. What, are they in the house?
No, they're out the property.
Are they seizing stuff again?
They're searching. There's a search warrant, so we're going to sit on this with the kids.
Okay.
logical.
Yeah.
So we'll see what transpires.
Okay. What do you want me to do? Pray.
What?
What do you want me to do? Yeah, pray. Well, yeah. Okay. What can I do for you?
I'm feeling pretty calm. I would call Mark or maybe just talk with him.
Did he talk to Marty?
I did call him, yes.
So he knows what they're doing?
Yeah. It's okay. Mm-hmm. Call from somebody else I need to talk to. I love you so much.
I love you. Should I try to call you later?
I don't know. I don't know. You can try, yeah. I'll answer if I can.
Okay.
I love you, and I'll talk soon.
Okay, baby. I love you.
Okay. Love you. Good night.
Unbelievable. It's the most evil thing I think I've ever heard of, you know. And then to keep everybody for like 9 months or so, you know, go through all the motions that they're still alive, you know, and she's protecting them. Even after they're arrested, you know, they never kind of gave an inch.
They were so smug, Lori is, that she basically boiled down Jolly Ranchers to make lipstick. Like, if I knew my kids were dead, research case, I have barely even washed my hair because I've been so stressed out about how sad it is.
But if you saw that footage of her at the early hearings, you know, in Rexburg, I mean, she's all got the lipstick on and everything. It's kind of like she's really playing to the gallery. You know, it's her big moment, I think.
Yeah, she thinks it's like she thinks she's a big star. Like so weird. Go back and forth on this, and maybe you can help me with your opinion. Because in your book, I was hoping that you would just tell me what you thought, and maybe just to ease my mind. It seems like she maybe radicalized him and was the manipulative one, but then it seems like he was her. Like, do you think one of them is more so than the other?
Well, she was pretty radicalized before she met him, you know. Once she was reading his books for a couple of years before, and she was following Julie Rose podcast and everything.
You said that Lori was radicalized before she met Chad.
Absolutely.
But like,
yeah.
who do you think was the leader amongst it? Like, who? Because it does seem like, so one of the really interesting things in your book was Chad doing that sort of diagram with like 7D or whatever, darker, whatever light, like.
Oh, it's just insane. I mean, you know, I don't know where he came up with that rubbish, you know. In fact, my publisher made me cut it down a lot. I did the whole thing originally and then I kind of cut it down. But it made no sense whatsoever. And I don't know, Chad's imagination just ran wild, I think, you know. I think Laurie, you know, had terrible, you know, issues growing up and throughout her life. I mean, she had a very, very rough life. And she kind of started reading Chad, and she was like a groupie, basically. And then she met Melanie Gibb, who had actually knew Chad. And this led her to meet Chad. And she comes along like, you know, this kind of groupie, you know, meeting her big rock star, you know, hero. And I think for Chad, it was basically like, you know, this beautiful woman that, because he was, you know, I understand his marriage was kind of falling apart. He wasn't really physically working with Tammy. They'd been together 29 years.
And I think he saw Laurie, you know, and saw the possibilities of being with Laurie, and, you know, and then told her she had all these magical, you know, spiritual powers that she didn't, you know, she knew she possessed, but he made it kind of fed into her ego totally, you know. So I think he manipulated her big time, you know.
Yeah, my gut, but I actually thought that maybe it was Laurie that, I don't know, maybe came on to him. I don't know.
Well, who knows how it went, but, you know, all through their lives, they always live within a, you know, striking distance of each other. Laurie moves and Alex moves down the road, you know, things like that. They never seem to be very far apart. And, I mean, Mary Tracy told me, you know, I thought it was very illuminating. She actually went to a Cox family party with Alex, you know, met the whole family, and it was on a barbecue day, and Laurie was walking around in a bikini in the house, you know, right, you know, kind of just, you know, showing off her body. And I asked Mary,
yeah.
I think Mary was very surprised by it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Mary and I talked about that. I was like, I mean, I'll only wear a bikini if I'm maybe laying down, maybe in front of, like, my dad or something, but, like...
Well, she was just flaunting herself.
Yeah, certainly I'm not going
to
prance around. Like, that is a sign of the weird... If everyone else is wearing plain clothes, too, it's not like a pool party.
Yeah.
May have had a hard upbringing, but a lot of people do. And they don't resort to this. I think there was a need for power for both of them, maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, the idea that they're saving the world and they're the king and queen, basically, of this group, coming to Armageddon. And they were going to lead the 144,000. I mean, that's what they really believed. And as you mentioned earlier, the portal, you know, just the idea they could travel through portals, you know, through time and space and everything. And Laurie told people that she didn't have to eat, she didn't have to go to the toilet, she didn't have to sleep, you know, she was kind of a translated being, I think was the expression. She had superpowers, and I think that she loved that, you know.
Did they know that they were full of shit, or was there a mental illness going on?
I mean, I wouldn't be the one. I'm not a psychiatrist. I mean, I think they believed it, you know, they kind of, and there was a group of them, you know, there was a whole tight group that Chad was leading, you know, into Armageddon. And they believed he was, they really believed he was, you know, a kind of a special priestly person, you know, a saint almost, you know, they believed it. And I think Laurie believed it. I mean, it's mental illness too, but you know, it's very powerful.
Yeah, he's just such an unimpressive person. And frankly, maybe it's just because I hate what they did to the kids. I don't think Lori's that impressive either. Yeah, certainly she's beautiful enough, but like,
yeah. But I have to say something that, I mean, Laurie has been declared kind of unfit for trial at the moment, and she's undergoing, you know, treatment to get, you know, for her competence. But I honestly don't believe that. I think she's fully competent. And I think, you know, if you just look at the time with Charles Vallow, you know, in that January before he died, when he calls the police and, you know, she says she's gone off the deep end, she's gone crazy, she's locked him out of the house, taken all his money and everything, stolen his car when he gets back from that business trip. And he tries to get her committed, and she goes voluntarily to this, you know, place that she has to be, you know, analyzed at with Melanie Gibb. And she just walked through it. She was smart enough to be able to, you know, walk out with flying colors. So I don't believe that Laurie is mentally ill at all, you know. I still don't think she's unfit.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's a defense attorney's tactic. It almost just sounds like greed to me. It's just greed and, like, maybe lust for each other. And
yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Chad wanted to be with a, you know, a pretty young woman, you know, after his marriage with four kids, five kids, and Laurie wanted the kind of power. You know, they both fed off each other, you know, for different reasons. No, you asked me what I'm working on now. I'm working on a book on the Murdoch family, Alex Murdoch in South Carolina.
Oh,
you know, the family that ran for over a century. They were the prosecutors, and they ran five counties in the Low Country in South Carolina. And after a boat crash involving his son, where this girl died because there was a, you know, underage drinking, the whole family's been brought down, basically, you know, and there's been a lot of deaths in the wake of that. So I'm working on that one at the moment.
I am fascinated by that story, and I can't wait to read your book.
Yeah, well, I've got to deliver it in 6 months, so I'm working hard on it. But
wow, have you gone down there and interviewed them?
Yeah. No, I've been down. I spent 3 weeks in South Carolina in November, so I interviewed people that know them and everything, you know, friends and stuff like that, and just as many people as I could.
Wow. And now, okay, one last question. I'm very curious, how did you get into your line of work? Like, did you go to college to be an investigative journalist? And then how did you get into the crime?
No, I'm a high school dropout, I guess, in London. Left school at 16 or 17 and sort of ended up in a local
you're like, reminded, like an Anthony Bourdain rock star. That's pretty cool.
Well, that's really, yeah. No, I ended up, I worked for local papers. In around the London, Surrey area, you know, for many years. And then I came to America and worked for magazines here. And eventually, you know, got into writing. I got a book deal about nearly 30 years ago for a book on Bill Graham. So I've just sort of I'm very lucky, and I've, you know, gone from there.
Oh, that's so cool. No, I love stories like that. Like, the one that's not, like, super linear, that it's just, like, you just found your passion and got, you know, I just think that's cool.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking with me, and you gave me so much good insight via this conversation and also your book. And,
yeah,
I think you're extremely talented.
And I aspire to be. Crazy enough, you know, because she was a great help to me, you know. She's a lovely lady, and she's very interesting. She probably knew Alex a lot better than a lot of people do.
I want to thank John Glatt, Mary Tracy, and Jill Kimmel for contributing to this story. And I want to end on a quote from Tylee's best friend, Vicia. She said, "If I had one more day with JJ and Tylee, I would want them to know how much they did for me, and just let them know that I love them. And I never met anyone like them, and I will always remember them like that." Thank you guys so much for listening, and if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts, and yeah, thank you. This is a shit case. I'm so sad for JJ and Tylee and the grandparents, and for Tammy. Those two people left a lot of carnage in their wake, and it's just heartbreaking. 7 Deadly Sinners was created and written by me, Rachel O'Brien. Research and writing assistance by Kate Codman. Sound design and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter.
Terrible consequences, and so many people, so many bodies in their wake, you know.